This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Well, welcome, everybody, to the Christmas edition of Against the Stream. I just finished a book. The book is called Into the Depths. And it was written by a friend of mine, and her name is Sister Mary Margaret Funk, better known as Sister Meg. And Sister Meg and I did a retreat together, I'm thinking in the late, maybe 97, 98, 99, something like that. I've got it on my website. It was a while ago. And I had met Sister Mary Margaret Funk, Sister Meg, because she was president of the Interreligious Monastic Dialogue. And this is an organization that brings Buddhist monks, nuns, Catholic monks and nuns together. And we talk about stuff. And we've had three Gethsemane encounters. The third one was Gethsemane 3, and it was about monastics and the environment. It's interesting when you meet a lot of people that sometimes you don't know who they are, or what their backstory is, or if you should be impressed or not be impressed. And I meet a lot of people, and I don't know who they are. So it's generally afterwards, sometimes years later, that I say, wow, that person was really cool. Why didn't I know all this stuff before? So I could have asked some meaningful questions or gone into deeper dialogue. That's perhaps one way of looking at it. But another way of looking at it is, if you don't know who you're talking to, there's a chance to just open up and feel comfortable and just talk and not feel intimidated or not feel defensive. And then later on you say, oh, I was talking to blah, blah, and they seem like a really nice person because I had no preconceived ideas of who they were or how I needed to be. So Sister Meg and I went to New Harmony, Indiana. And New Harmony, Indiana, twice in its history, had two utopian communities. And these are communities that were led by religious people who were trying to create a utopia. And one of them was Reverend Rapp, R-A-P-P, German fellow. The problem with these utopian communities is basically it's a bunch of men and women living together in celibacy. And it just doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun. You know, I don't know if you'd want to have that as your utopia, but they thought it would work fine. And what they did in New Harmony is they built these watchtowers. And if you go there today, they're still in place and they're still there. And the watchtowers were manned and womaned every day of the year. And they were manned and womaned because this was watching for the end of the world. And so they were going to then alert everybody in the utopian community that utopia was over and they were going to go meet their maker. Well, the first one died off, and then somebody else moved in and tried to do it again, and that didn't work either. So now it's just sort of a historical site where people go and look at where people tried to have a utopia. And then last night, I just happened to have in my video collection 2012. Remember that movie? Came out a couple years ago? The End of the World? So we're all getting ready for it. Mayan calendar ends next year. And I love the way L.A. was just destroyed. They really did a good job. And so I thought about our retreat, and it was myself and Sister Meg talking about the rule of St. Benedict. The rule of St. Benedict, if you haven't heard of that, is how monks live together. And it's an old, small, precise book on how to live together. And it's more about how to live in community and find your inner reality. It was a lot of it came from the Desert Fathers, as Sister Meg told me, who had gone to the desert to find silence and to find God. And what they found instead were themselves. Because if you leave behind the exterior, you can't leave behind the interior. So there's always something going on and some challenge to make. And so Sister Meg and I spoke to 40 Episcopalians about the rule of St. Benedict from a Catholic perspective and a Buddhist perspective. And I was fairly prepared. It's really hard to prepare for stuff like that until you've had some life experience and some other challenges, but it turned out okay. And Sister Meg has written a book, as I said, called Into the Depths, and it's about her journey as a monk. And I had no idea what her journey was like. And she joined the convent at 17. In 1961, she moved in to the convent. And she's been there ever since. She took a vow of stability. And a vow of stability in the Catholic tradition is that it will be your home base until you die. And then you'll be buried in the backyard. And there's oftentimes a cemetery in back of these convents and monasteries. And if you ever get a chance to go to Gethsemane, there's a wonderful cemetery there with all the monks who have died, and Father Thomas Merton is there, and he always has a little wreath or flowers over his cross, people like him. And so Sister Meg, at the age of 17, became a nun, and she's been a nun for over 50 years now, and she has been in therapy for over 40 years. And she has done some fascinating things, has traveled around the world, has taught, has been in charge of, has practiced, has found her inner stuff. And yet somehow she still struggles. And the struggles entail having been moved by God twice, she said, in her all those years of practice and prayer. And then the rest of the time having faith. And I thought to myself, being Christmas, and this is when Jesus was born, you know, and you go, wow, isn't that interesting? What does it mean to us who are here today at Against the Stream, a Buddhist meditation center, on the day Christ was born? And how can I tie this all together with Sister Meg? So this is what I came up with. Birth allows us to have 100% potential. So when Jesus was born, we all had the potential to be saved. And all we needed to do was believe and have faith. And because he died on the cross, and because there was grace, our salvation is insured. Well, for most of us sitting here, probably not the case. I know when I was a Lutheran, I had 100% potential to be saved. And when I became a Buddhist, I needed to be saved in maybe a different way. That potential had been lost, and I had fully realized as much of that path as I was going to realize. So then I became a Buddhist. And then I had full potential to become saved in a nirvanic sense or an enlightened sense. But as we grow and mature in our practice, we have less and less potential and hopefully more and more realization. But are we going to become fully realized before our potential wears out? And that's the real dilemma. And what do we need to do? So I'm going to talk about a secular perspective first and then a spiritual perspective. I called a friend of mine. His name is Peter. I called him yesterday and wished him a Merry Christmas. We lived one house apart in the 50s. We went to grade school together. And we're still in contact. And it's interesting to talk to someone who you knew then and now how they are today. And this year, like myself, he just started to get his Social Security. Now, that may not sound like a big deal, but you know, all of us, if we're working, have the potential to get Social Security. But not all of us are going to realize our Social Security, because some of us are going to die. Some of us may join the clergy and say, I don't want my Social Security. I've taken a vow of poverty. Perhaps. But here we are, and we both realize our Social Security. And next year, we realize a 3.6% increase in our Social Security. How about that? And you go, okay, well, I had years and years of potential, and it finally turned into realization. He had his own business, still does, draftsman, employed his family, did very well until about 2008. And now he's thinking about closing down the business. He hates it. And not only does he hate it, he's not making any money. So he says, what's the point? And he has enough money to retire, and he gets his Social Security. And so that realization now has sort of come to its end. And I said, what are you going to do? He said, I don't know. But what I like about what you did is you lived your passion, which I thought was an interesting way of putting it. I said, well, in living my passion, I didn't really make a whole lot of money. And he said, but that's not the point. The point is you lived what you wanted to do or were called to do or found it interesting to do. And I've done something for 30 years that just made money. And it doesn't interest me at all right now. So I want to find my passion. I want to find my potential before I die. It seems to me that our potential comes out of birth, and that if we're reborn enough times, we can continue to have more and more potential. So when we were in grade school, we fully realized that and went to high school and fully realized that and maybe went to college and fully realized that and maybe went into a career and started to fully realize that, and then we went into retirement and fully realized that. But all those little segments of our journey on this planet came about because we continued to be reborn as different people all the time. And what we started to understand is that to be reborn again, to find that new potential, we had to die. So we had to die as the grade school person and the high school person and the college person. And sometimes I talk to people and you realize they haven't fully died yet, because they're like 50 and talking about college and you're going, well, okay. And I suppose that's okay. But in order to get that rebirth started again, we really have to die to who we used to be. And that can be challenging because a lot of us don't know how to die well, and how to be reborn again. In the spiritual path that a lot of us have taken, it seems to me that our job is to die as often as we can. And in Buddhism, what they talk about is this rebirth. And some folks poo-poo that concept that, well, I don't believe in rebirth and I don't believe in reincarnation, and how can you prove that? And I don't think that's really the point. I think the point is in this lifetime, how many times can we be reborn? And I think it's infinite. I think every moment of every day gives us another chance to be reborn. You have a bad morning, but you can have a great afternoon. You have a great afternoon, you can have a terrible evening. And we keep getting reborn, and sometimes it's the hell realm, and sometimes it's the heaven realm, and sometimes it's the human realm. And each one of those opportunities is a chance to have new potential and new realization. So when I died as a Christian and was reborn as a Buddhist, I took the five precepts. I had a little Buddhist ceremony. And the Buddhist ceremony allowed me to have my Buddhist name. And then I had the five precepts and the three refuges, and I got a certificate suitable for framing, signed by some people that I liked. And I thought to myself, this is cool. Now I'm a real Buddhist, whatever that means. And I'm really happy about being a real Buddhist. And then I started to realize that as a layperson, and said to myself, maybe I should die as a layperson and be reborn as a monastic. Maybe I should see what potential that holds for me. So after a year of holding the five precepts, I decided to be a postulant, and I decided to take the eight precepts, which is the beginning of the monastic path. And so I took the eight precepts, and I thought to myself, this is really cool. I've been reborn again now into this sort of monastic thing, and look at all the potential I have. I have enlightenment as my potential, and nirvana as my potential, and maybe I never have to work again as my potential, and people will support me as my potential. And I'm going, that is so cool. But in order to fully realize this path, I needed to continue to die and be reborn. So I died as a postulant and was reborn as a novice monk, taking the 10 precepts. And then the vows or the precepts I followed allowed me to understand that I needed to realize this and I needed to avoid realizing this. So in our realization, in our path to realization, some things we want to realize. We want to realize generosity, compassion, love, wisdom. But what we don't want to realize is greed, hatred, delusion, lust, ignorance. Those are the things we all have potential for, just like the positive aspects. But we don't have to realize them. Now, one of the aspects of any path, whether it be secular or spiritual, is to test things out. Well, I wonder what this realization feels like. And so how does generosity feel? Well, we've just had, you know, a celebration of mandatory generosity. We call that Christmas. And the stores were open late and people were charging and having just so much fun giving, as well as hoping to receive. So we have this sort of mandatory generosity. But how does it feel not to have generosity manifest naturally? To give from the heart. Not because you want anything in return, but just because you want to give. And that giving decreases your own greed, your own clinging and attachment. And so, as we start to realize our potential, we start to see there are certain things we want to realize and certain things we don't. And this path that we're on allows us to turn our potential into realization. And what that means to me is there's nothing outside we need to get. We already have all the stuff we already need. And it's all in here, but it's locked in here. It's locked in our potential. And the magic of the path that some of us are on, the Buddhist path, is this path guarantees you, not through grace, but through practice, to transform that potential into realization. And what realization are we talking about? Being a fully realized human being in nirvana. And a fully realized human being in nirvana never has to suffer again, never has to be reborn again, has reached the fruition of that path that was given to us because of the birth of Siddhartha. That was, if he hadn't been born, none of us would have this kind of potential. And I think that's fascinating. And the Christians are looking at Jesus and probably saying the same thing. If Jesus hadn't been born, their potential would have been much different. So can we appreciate this potential? Can we use it to our advantage? I think we can, but I think we need to keep it in perspective too, because until we achieve that realization, it requires us to practice. And it could be a daily practice or a weekly practice or a monthly practice, however much time you have to practice. And it may not need to be a traditional practice in a zendo or a meditation center or a temple. It could be at Vons or Target, your practice. Can you practice generosity at Vons by letting somebody step in front of you? So yesterday I was at Food for Less buying cat food, which I do quite often. and this woman comes up to me and goes, "Mong," and I don't want. And she's speaking Spanish. And she just, like, talking to me like I knew what the heck she was talking about. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't speak Spanish. And she spoke no English. So the other person in line said, she's saying she only has one item, can she get in front of you? And I said, yes. She understood yes. And she got in front of me. And it was a bit chaotic yesterday because it seemed everybody needed to get a few last-minute items for Christmas, and I needed to get my cat food. And how did it feel? Well, there was sort of this equanimity about it. You know, I didn't feel joyful in giving her that place in front of me, and I didn't feel sad about giving that place in front of me. It really didn't change my life dramatically in any positive or negative way. It was just sort of okay. And I think probably as we mature in our practice, we don't take great joy or take great offense when somebody steps in front of us. We just simply allow it to happen as being the natural course of affairs. The conditions necessary have manifested for that person to be in front of you. Okay. And then you go, isn't that interesting? Can we appreciate the flow of our life? And when the flow of our life is not going in a correct way because we've realized something that wasn't skillful, can we then revert to our practice and take refuge in that and say to ourselves, you know, my life could be better today if I would just simply practice. And we don't need to practice anything mystical. We only need to practice the simple stuff, like maybe the five precepts. If you say to yourself, today I'm just going to practice the five precepts and see what happens. See if my life works better or worse. And in practicing the five precepts, what we attempt to do is not realize the negative. The five precepts are designed for us not to realize the negative, but to keep that as potential. And then, as we get more clever in our practice, we turn those precepts around and we start to say, okay, I'm not going to kill today, but I'm also going to encourage life. And then you say to yourself, I'm not going to steal today, but I'm also going to be a bit more generous. And then you say to yourself, I'm not going to be indulging in sexual misconduct today, but I'm going to be a little more loving. And so it's not all negative. Maybe in the beginning it's all negative, but as we mature and start to practice, a lot of that positive stuff comes out. So now we're going to work the other side. You know, and then finally, you know, the fifth precept, which is probably the hardest one to practice, is not to consume intoxicants. And everybody at Fruitful S was getting intoxicants yesterday by the case. You know? And I'm going, okay. So realizing sobriety, realizing clarity in our day. How does it feel to celebrate a holiday with clarity? It may feel pretty good. You may actually get the true meaning of the holiday, you know, what it's supposed to do instead of what it does, and cool. So as we go through our practice, as we try to realize our potential in the positive and not realize it in the negative, we start to see that there is a chance at full realization before we die. The Buddha achieved full realization at 35. Wow, that is so cool. But as long as we have some brain activity, our potential is still there. As long as there's any brain activity at all, even in our last moments, that potential is still there. The potential to realize our full perfection as a human being. So this birth we had to, in my case, a few years ago, gave me the potential for realization. The birth that the Buddha had gave humanity the potential for full realization. If you're a Christian, the birth of Jesus, which is being celebrated today, gives you the potential for salvation through grace. Very cool. And as I look at today, I'm thinking to myself, this is a great day to be alive. It's another day to practice. It's another day to have lunch. Another day to have dinner. Another day to pet the cats. It's another day. And how joyful can that be? Now, I want to digress just a bit and talk about Thaisar Bhikkhu in his book called Selves and Not Self. And this came from a retreat he did, and it's a large booklet or a small book, and it's three audios on it, and it's just fascinating. And he talks about the dilemma of not self, which will tie into what I've been speaking about. And he says, you know, the real key to understanding selves and not self is the fact that we don't want to kill self, we don't want to deny self. What we want to do is create a self that's skillful. We have an opportunity in every moment to have a new self. And these selves are relative, not ultimate, and these selves allow us to work in a very complicated world and be skillful in a very complicated world and suffer less. And the idea is to create conditions necessary for skillful selves to be born. And deny the conditions necessary for unskillful selves to be born. And again, this practice that we all find ourselves, or some of us find ourselves connected to, is designed to create self. And it sounds odd, but it's designed to create self out of emptiness. That emptiness gives us full potential. Once the emptiness starts to fill up with who we are or who we want to be, or what we should be, or what we need to be, we have less and less potential, and more realization. And sometimes we have so much realization, we lose all future potential. And for Buddhists, that would be a bad thing. Now, one of the books that came out a couple years ago called The Secret, they talked about you can have anything you want. You know, and everybody bought that book because they all wanted to get what they really wanted. And if you think about it carefully, what they're saying is that you can have anything you want, but it's limited to what you know. Now, if you're like me, you realize that most of the stuff in the world you don't know. That there's just a small little piece of the world that you think you know. And wouldn't it be just terrible to limit ourselves to what we know? Isn't one of the joys of life finding out new things, you know? Like going to Griffith Park and finding the observatory and going, wow, this is so cool. I didn't know it was here. If we look at our life as an unfolding of emptiness into fullness, into who we think we are, who we need to be, who we want to be, these selves can come to life in a very specific way. They can come to life through our practice. And if you practice the five precepts and do daily meditation and read the Dharma, that self that arises from those conditions will be unique and useful in the world. And so as I look at the birth and death, the sense of the potential of birth, and the full realization that always happens in death. Because as soon as you die, there's no more potential, and you're going to be as fully realized as you're ever going to be. Can we reach that full realization before we die? In a sense of perfection of nirvana, compassion, love, kindness, generosity, wisdom. Can we do that? And the Buddha said, absolutely. So not only did the Buddha give us salvation, he said, you can have your salvation before you die. I got mine at 35, and this is how I did it. And there are about 100 books that tell us how he did it and allow us to figure out how we can do it. So even though there may be grace in Christianity, you got to die first, it seems to me. In Buddhism, you don't have to die in the physical sense. You simply need to die into the emptiness of your life, which gives you the full potential necessary for realization. I'm going to stop there because it's getting sort of complicated, but I would love to have somebody comment. Yes?
Given that we have memory, how empty can you become? In other words, does your grade school self, your college self, your Lutheran self walk with you?
Yeah, that's really good. Well, those are the ghosts of who you used to be, you know. And you were only that person for a moment. And in that moment, you lived and died. And the ghosts are still with us. And a lot of the ghosts are very specific. You know, we have edited the ghosts down to make them either into a victim or a victor or the center of attention or on the sidelines. And to be honest with you, when I think back to my grade school and high school years, I thought I was the center of attention. But I've contacted people who went to grade school and high school with me, and they don't remember who I was. And I'm going, why was my reality so different? You know. So I saw that. Interesting that those people lived, and because they lived, I live today. Some of them, though, and Sister Meg talked about it in her book, you know, Therapy for 40 Years, she dealt with those people she used to be getting in the way of who she was today, who she is today. And so she went into therapy to try to figure that out. And I think perhaps maybe another way of looking at it would be to just kill those people and have a memorial service. And look back at that 16-year-old kid who thought he was the center of attention and put him to rest. Give him say a few words, put him to sleep, and continue. You know, all those people that we used to be are why we're here today, but why we're here today or what we're doing today will create who we're going to be tomorrow. And that's the most important part of this whole journey is trying to figure out how to stay in the present moment. And when I speak to people who sort of relate to themselves as coming from another city or another state or their education, they're using that as a reference point, and they're sort of, you know, trying to figure out what to do today based on that. And it's odd, to me, that shouldn't you base what you're going to do today on today? And use all the resources available to you through all your education and experience and intuition to decide what you're going to do right now in this very present moment. And if that's the case, more than likely, there won't be any prejudice or preconceived ideas or anything. It'll just be responding to that present moment experience in your life rather than how you're supposed to do it or how you should do it. So those people were really cool. I have pictures of those people I used to be, you know, and I appreciate the fact that they walked on the earth, but they don't really give me much today, you know. And when I speaking to my friend Peter, who I went to school with and lived next door to, or a doorway, that guy I knew died a long time ago, so it's sort of cool to meet the new guy who took his place, who's gray now and getting Social Security and a bit wiser and a bit sadder, you know, because he's seen the trials and tribulations of life. Whereas, you know, in school sometimes we have all this hope and anticipation of how our life is going to be. And then at 60 we go, damn, you know, this is it, you know. So sort of that kind of thing. Yeah, and I'm not saying that therapy isn't good. It's good to talk that stuff out, but the ghosts, you know, we have Halloween and we have things like that. And that's when we honor the ghosts, you know. And they're always going to be there with us. We can't deny the fact, but they don't have to have much of an impact on us. They can just be an interesting phenomena, which is what we were 50 years ago or 20 years ago or 10 years ago. We were just an interesting phenomena. And not interesting to everybody, apparently. Anybody else have anything they'd like to share?
I'm a little confused by the way you describe realization and potential. What do you mean by realization? Could you be more descriptive?
I can. I'll give you an example. A couple years ago, I decided that I wanted to learn how to play the ukulele. And I had played guitar for a while, for years, and never, you know, it was just sort of sitting there, and I'd pick it up and put it down, but it was okay. So I got the ukulele. And the ukulele has only four strings opposed to six, and they're tuned differently than the guitar. So I had to learn that. I had to, learn how to tune it and learn how to strum it. And then the chords are different, too. So I had to learn some new chords. Okay, so when I bought that ukulele, I had only potential and no realization. And I said, how am I going to turn that potential into realization? And so I looked at myself and said, well, you don't have any talent, so that's not going to work. But you do have time to practice. And that may make up for your lack of talent. So every day, and it sounds funny, but I'd be on the computer and I'd be doing my websites and answering my email, and I'd have the little ukulele sitting right next to me. And when there was a download or a moment, I would pick it up and I'd do some chords, do a couple of strums. And what happened was that practice was allowing my potential to begin to manifest in realization. Okay? What I would call realization in this case would be performance. So I would practice and practice and practice. And then one day I got secure in my practice, and I videotaped myself and I looked at it and said, well, no, you're not there yet. You still got more potential than realization. You need some more practice. But eventually, I was actually able to do a song and pull it off, and it sounded like I knew what I was doing. And so I was almost realized, but not fully. And then it happened, I think at UCLA, when there were the students and there was an activity and people were singing, and I brought my ukulele, and I was going to sing in front of a group of people. Well, you get really self-conscious and you sort of lose all the mind states that were available to you when you practice, because you had this sort of relative focus on how to do this and how to do that. And then you just sort of have to do it. Well, I actually stood in front of all these people and just did it. And they applauded. And it might have been, they just felt they needed to applaud. Or they may have really meant it. I'm not quite sure. But I interpreted that as going from practice to performance, going from potential to realization. And I saw that it was sort of an evolutionary process. Just because you have the potential doesn't mean it's ever going to turn into realization unless you do something about it, unless you can create some conditions necessary for realization to occur. And in my practice, I was putting together the conditions necessary for that ukulele performance. And so now, that's an oversimplification, of course, and when you're talking about a life or a spiritual practice, it's far more complicated. But I have never been talented in my spirituality, but I've made time to practice and had time to practice, and that practice allows me to get to some places in my presentation where it just sort of flows more naturally, without any kind of preconceived ideas of what I need to say or what I should say. And I was telling Holly earlier that when I'm not being recorded, I can be less concerned about the flow. And when I'm being recorded, I have to be sort of monitoring the flow a little bit, because if it goes on the internet and a million people hear it, or even 1,000 people hear it, there are going to be 1,000 different ways of listening to what I say. And that's when the emails start, either really good or really bad. So this idea of practice has been an important focus for me in my life, because I really haven't had much talent in anything I've ever done. But if I was practicing, or studying, or just sticking with it until it finally happened, I could see progress, and I could see some form of realization. So when I came to the Eightfold Path, I'm going, whoa. This is so cool, because this is a path of practice, which is what I didn't find in Christianity. What I found in Christianity was somebody else had to do it for you. And you had to be a certain way for them to do it for you. You had to be humble, with humility, which is a good thing in Buddhism as well. You had to have faith, you had to believe. And then you had these little middlemen, or middle things, that would finally allow you to come into relationship with whatever it is. And I'm thinking to myself, well, the path of practice is for right now, and it's total human transformation from unskillful to skillful, depending how unskillful you are when you start and how skillful you end up after you're finished. And I was really unskillful when I started. And I saw movement in a good way early on. I saw my life changing and the way I thought about my life changing simply because I was practicing the Eightfold Path. What happens, unfortunately, is we plateau a lot. We reach this plateau and it doesn't sound like, feel like anything's happening. You know, and you keep practicing and keep meditating and you do a couple more retreats. And it doesn't get any better, it doesn't get any worse. And those are the times I have found when at a subconscious level, the practice continues. And it's setting the foundation for your consciousness. And ultimately, after you go through the trials and tribulations of your subconscious, your conscious perspective is much healthier and wholesome. I found 3 or 4 years of really tough subconscious work, that just this stuff kept coming up. You talk about, you know, the stuff when we're younger and it keeps coming up. Gosh, when you're in meditation and it's really quiet and all the stuff comes up and there's no place to run or hide, you just have to look at it and go, geez, was I a jerk, you know. Then you got to let that go too, because you were just doing the best you could at the time. And then you got to let that go too, and then you got to let that go too, and then finally it just comes up and you look at it and it goes away. And you don't have to react or respond anymore to it. You know, so this practice is just really a fascinating journey in itself, because what Sister Meg says in her book is when all is said and done, it's her vows that have become the most important thing in her life. Her vows as a nun. You know? And so our precepts or our practice ultimately could be the most important things in our life. Even more important than who we are or what we need to do. Because those keep defining us in a very special way. That practice, those precepts, that Eightfold Path. So realization, potential, it's sort of, for me, relative, ultimate. It's this false dichotomy that's created. You know, in reality, there is no potential and there is no realization. We're already fully realized, it's just we don't know it. As the Zen people would say, you know. So our job is to know it, to find out that that's the case. And the practice of Buddhism, for me, allows me to have deeper insight into that. Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks. I should have brought my ukulele. I couldn't have played you some. Well, with that, let me do a loving kindness meditation, so we can continue our day and realize the beauty that's ahead for us in this day. May those of us who have come together today in mind and heart be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to us. May no difficulties come to us. May no problems come to us. May we always find fulfillment. May we also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May our parents, our partners, our pets, our brothers and sisters, our friends and family, all the people we don't know and all the people we don't like, may they too be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to them. May no difficulties come to them. May no problems come to them. May they always find fulfillment. May they also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. From the highest realm of existence to the lowest may all beings arisen in any of these realms, with form and without, with perception and without, with consciousness and without, may they too be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to them. May no difficulties come to them. May no problems come to them. May they always find fulfillment. May they also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May the suffering ones be suffering free, the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief. May the sick find health, relief.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.